So we're talking about, as Rob mentioned, transformation or metamorphosis, and this is in the overall series that we're working on through the summer called The Character of God. And I did title the message The Lawgiver, even though it would have been optimal or even prime to call it God the Transformer, but the joke was still funny. Even though we kind of had Transformers on the picture. So God the Lawgiver, and why that works out, and how transform and lawgiving works together is something we'll discuss as we go through today. First, I'd like to start with a story, and if I ever decide to make a career change and go from pastoral ministry into something else, I think I would become a chef. That is my favorite hobby, is cooking. And it's a really good change of pace in my life to sit down and create a meal. And it's easy to kind of, for me to judge whether I did a good job or not. Because if I want to eat seconds, then I can feel like I've accomplished something good and go from there. Cooking, you need good ingredients. And you need to make sure you have the right mixture of ingredients. And there's a few times when I was learning to cook curry that I did not get that mixture right, and it was terrible and couldn't eat it, had to throw it out. It was way too spicy. But that's an important part of cooking, is getting the mixture right. You need good ingredients and you need the right combination of ingredients. But when you get kind of a recipe down, then you can throw in a little bit of your own touch, even if you're working from a recipe and like, all right, so I'll add a little bit of this, a little bit of that to make it taste how you envision it or how you want your own meal to taste. Baking isn't quite like this. If you mess up an ingredient, you can also really mess things up, probably even more so. Like with baking powder, your pancakes, you just take exactly like baking powder, which has happened a few times, and stuff like that. So why this long story? It's because the New Testament is a mixture of complex flavors which are put together to bring the stories to life. The authors of the New Testament pull from all these different ingredients that is the Old Testament story, these different stories, and they bring it together and make a mixture. So even when you can't necessarily taste the Old Testament, as sometimes you can't taste certain ingredients, but they're important to the overall meal, like onions and garlic is like that. You can't always taste it, but it's an important flavor starter. So the authors of the New Testament, they will use a pinch of this, a teaspoon of that, and often a whole big heaping of Moses. Moses is one of those kind of ingredients that is in so many elements of the Old Testament story. And he was the one whom the law was spoken to. And so I want to read a few passages tonight for the recipe of the Transfiguration story to help to put them out there. It's important when you're making a meal to check your fridge, check your pantry, to make sure you have everything you need, so you don't get to the end and be like, the cream is bad or something like that, and then you can't finish the meal. So I want to read four passages at the beginning, and we're going to start with the main passage in Mark, and then read a couple Exodus passages, and then Malachi. And hopefully this will all create a good, flavorful blend for this story, the transfiguration of Jesus, where his glory is then revealed, and he is changed. So starting with Mark, page 1534 in your pew Bibles. "Six days later, Jesus took Peter, James, and John and led them up a hill mountain to be alone. As the men watched, Jesus' appearance was transformed, and his clothes became dazzling white, far whiter than any earthly bleach could ever make them. Then Elijah and Moses appeared and began talking with Jesus. Peter exclaimed, 'Rabbi, it is wonderful for us to be here. Let's make three shelters as memorials, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah.' He said this because he didn't know what else to say, for they were all terrified. Then a cloud overshadowed them, and a voice from the cloud said, 'This is my dearly loved son. Listen to him.' Suddenly, when they looked around, Moses and Elijah were gone, and they only saw Jesus with them. As they went back down the mountain, he told them not to tell anyone what they had seen until the Son of Man had risen from the dead. So they kept it to themselves. but they often asked each other what he meant by rising from the dead. Then they asked him, "Why do the teachers of religious law insist that Elijah must return before the Messiah comes?" Jesus responded, "Elijah is indeed coming first to get everything ready. Yet why do the scriptures say that the Son of Man must suffer greatly and be treated with utter contempt? But I tell you, Elijah has already come, and they chose to abuse him, just as the scriptures predicted." So flipping back to Exodus 24 on this page, 114 in your 115 actually, sorry, in your pew Bibles. "Then Moses, Aaron, Nabu, and Abihu, and the 70 elders of Israel climbed up the mountain. There they saw the glory of Israel. Under his feet there seemed to be a surface of brilliant blue lapis lazuli, as clear as the sky itself. And though these nobles of Israel gazed upon God, he did not destroy them. In fact, they ate a covenant meal, eating and drinking in the presence. Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Come up to me on the mountain. Stay there, and I will give you the tablets of stone on which I have inscribed the instructions and commands, so you can teach the people.' So Moses and his assistant Joshua set out, and Moses climbed up the mountain of God. Moses told the elders, 'Stay here and wait for us until we come back. Aaron and Hur are here with you. If anyone has a dispute while I am gone, consult with them.' Then Moses climbed up the mountain, and the cloud covered it. And the glory of the Lord settled on Mount Zion, and the cloud covered it for 6 days. On the seventh day, the Lord called to Moses from inside the cloud. To the Israelites at the foot of the mountain, the glory of the Lord appeared at the summit like a consuming fire. Then Moses disappeared into the cloud as he climbed higher up the mountain. He remained on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights." I meant to set the context of Exodus before we got into it. And this is after Moses had been to Egypt and had confronted Pharaoh, and God, through his mighty acts, had delivered the people. And then they had traveled to Sinai. And this is the mountain that Moses originally encountered God on. And here then is the time when God gives the law to Moses to form the covenant with his people, but what it means to be his people, to be his royal priesthood, his holy nation, to truly reflect God's image in the world. So this is part of the covenant law-giving process. So then flipping over, in the intervening material, the people had broken the covenant. They had created an idol with their own hands to worship the golden calf. And then Moses comes down, judges the people, throws the original tablets of stone with God's own handwriting on them. And then he goes back up the mountain, and he requests an encounter with God to confirm his leadership, to demonstrate that he can truly do this task that God has set before him. And we're going to read the passage of that encounter here, or the prequel to that encounter here. Not the prequel, the After Effects, sorry. Yeah. Moses remained there on the mountain with the Lord 40 days and 40 nights. In all that time, he ate no bread and drank no water. And the Lord wrote the terms of the covenant, the Ten Commandments, on the stone tablets. When Moses came down Mount Sinai, carrying the two tablets of stone inscribed with the terms of the covenant, he wasn't aware that his face had become radiant because he had spoken to the Lord. So when Aaron and the people of Israel saw the radiance of Moses' face, they were afraid to come near him. And then reading a passage in Malachi, which kind of binds this all together, like flour binds a sauce together. That wasn't in my notes, it just came to me. With Moses, Elijah, and the mountain. Malachi being in the Christian forming of the canon. This is the last passage as they look forward towards the advent of the coming of the Lord. "Remember to obey the law of Moses, my servant, all the decrees and regulations that I gave to him on Mount Sinai for all Israel. Look, I'm sending you the prophet Elijah before the great and dreadful day of the Lord arrives. His preaching will turn the hearts of fathers to their children and the heart of children to their fathers. Otherwise, I will come and strike the land with a curse." So hopefully you can see the ingredients that are making up this passage, the different things that are in the background. So yeah, in Exodus, this is after God's mighty act, his act of redeeming his people out of Egypt, out of slavery, out of oppression, and bringing them to the land that he had promised to them on oath. And they're in the middle of this journey, and they're waiting to, geographically in the middle of this journey, and they're waiting to then progress into the promised land. This moment of the Exodus, where God redeems his people, comes up so much in Old Testament language. It's one of the key ingredients, and this is often in the people after the exile, when they're longing for God to then again redeem his people, to break into history and to save them out of desperation, out of desolation, out of a situation of oppression. And even though they weren't slaves like they were in Egypt, after the exile, they were continually ruled by other people, and they longed for freedom, where God would be their king, where he would rule over them and be ruled by an Israelite ruler, not just foreigners. And that was kind of the great hope. So the prophets, especially Elijah and Jeremiah, pull on this language to talk about this new exodus that they're hoping for, they're longing for. And so Mark, for example, pulls on a lot of Isaiah's new exodus language and brings it up as an ingredient in the background to demonstrate that what Jesus is doing is fulfilling this hope, fulfilling what the people had always hoped would come about in Jesus' life and ministry. And he uses these ingredients to help tell the story, to help explain what Jesus is doing in his action. And this is indeed an intervention of God, as Jesus is revealed to his people, and he is delivering them once again. So we have this mountaintop experience where we see Jesus with Moses and Elijah. And Moses was encountered by God on Sinai. So this transfiguration scene is a new Sinai situation, a new encounter that God is having and confirming Jesus' leadership, his lordship, his being God in the world. And there's several several points of interconnectedness between this, called Moses connections, or Moses typology. And they are on the screen in the background. So we have, and I'll put this on the blog if you want to refer back to it later, but we have 6 days in the 6 day waiting period that Moses had before going up the mountain. We have Mark highlighting that it was 6 days after Jesus had last spoke. And then we have companions who ascend up the mountain with both Moses and with Jesus. And then it's a cloud of glory descending and a voice speaking out of this that is able to be heard. And we have radiance, both of Moses and of Jesus. And we have the longing for a tabernacle with Peter. And then we have the tabernacle actually being built, the instructions for it previous to Moses descending in the golden calf situation. And then it's construction after that, which highlights another Moses interconnected. So these are all pulling in these different seasonings, these different ingredients, which bring this to a rich, flavorful narrative. And so what Mark is doing, he's licking these great figures in the Old Testament, especially to Moses, the great lawgiver, the one that gave the people instructions about what it meant to reflect the image and glory of the God that the people were worshiping, were in covenant relationship with. And these figures, Moses and Elijah, they are types. They point forward to the ultimate fulfillment of who Jesus is, as Moses being the great lawgiver and Elijah being the great prophet. And Jesus fulfills these longings, the expectations, these hopes. And it's important to recognize that Jesus eclipses both of these characters. He eclipses Elijah, he eclipses Moses. He is not just the fulfillment, he is beyond the fulfillment of these anticipations and these hopes, as he is God breaking forth into the story of history. I want to also highlight something that is missing in this text as Jesus comes down the mountain. Moses has the tablets of stone in his hands. But Jesus, his hands are empty as he descends on the mountain. And these tablets that were Moses' hands were supposed to point to the people what it meant to live in relationship with God and in relationship with those around them, to love God on one tablet, to love neighbor as yourself on the other tablet. These are what it means to reflect the image and the glory of the Lord as Moses descends from the mountain. But as Jesus descends, he doesn't have new tablets in his hands. But what he has is himself. He is now the embodiment of what it means to be in relationship with God, what it means to be truly human, what it means to be God's image bearers. Because this new law, the new law that God is commanding through revealing himself in the world through Jesus, is written on and in Jesus' life. To understand what the new law is, what the new Torah is to look at how Jesus goes about his ministry. And it's interesting that this transfiguration scene is actually bridged by these prophecies about Jesus giving over his life. It says Jesus predictions, that's the word I was looking for, predictions of Jesus giving over his life, what it means to suffer. And it's this type of self-giving, self-pouring out love that is truly highlighted in what it means to be God's image bearers. Another scene in this text is Elijah, and that's where the Malachi passage comes in, and the instruction for the people to listen to what Jesus is saying. And this highlights that Jesus is the new lawgiver, the one that the people should follow, should listen to, should emulate, should give their life over to. He is the new lawgiver, but not in the style of rules that were there in Torah in the Old Testament. His life is the law. And it's given to us to know what it means to be transformed into the likeness of the God whom we worship. And Jesus also doesn't descend the mountain alone. He descends it with his disciples. And this is another part of what it means to be, for Jesus to be the new lawgiver. It's that those disciples who are with Jesus, who are encountering with Jesus, who are being transformed into his likeness, are supposed to continue on in this embodying what it means to be God's law in the way that they live their life, in the way that they continue on his ministry, as they continue to reflect his image and glory, as that perpetuates moving forward throughout history. He descends on the mountain being the true lawgiver, and descends with his disciples, whom he's empowering and transforming to continue on the announcement that Jesus is indeed Lord of the world and is making all things new. Many meals need a finishing touch, and sometimes they need a little garnish or a little extra flavoring, whether it be cilantro, lime, sour cream would be the big thing in my house as a little extra scoop, where Noah will just eat the sour cream and not the other stuff. But sometimes you need a little bit of an extra flavoring to a meal, salt or whatever. And I try hard not to let the Apostle Paul be my interpreter of the Gospels. And so I often try not to preach from a gospel text and then just use Paul to interpret it. But Paul is very, very helpful in this whole passage and this whole theme. And it's because he's pulling from the same ingredients of the Old Testament that Mark is pulling from in Mark 9. And it is linked by that word that we translate transform or metamorphosis, the one word that we get from. And he links this in a way that he even extends the story. In Mark 9, we see how Jesus, his glory is fully revealed, and how it's a confirmation of who Jesus is and who he as new lawgiver. And the way Paul picks up on this image is he extends it to us then being transformed through the working of the Spirit. And the passage is 2 Corinthians 3, and don't have a slide for it. But 2 Corinthians, Corinthians 3, and it's all pulling from the same image, the same story. And I'm going to start reading from verse 9 and continue into verse 18. The old way, with law etched in stone, led to death, though it began with such glory that the people of Israel could not bear to look at Moses' face. For his face shone with the glory of God, even though the brilliance was already fading away. Shouldn't we expect far greater glory under the new way, now that the Holy Spirit is giving life? If the old way, which brings condemnation, was glorious, how much more glorious is the new way, which makes us right with God? In fact, that first glory was not glorious at all compared with the overwhelming glory of the new way. So if the old way, which has been replaced, was glorious, how much more glorious is the new, which remains forever? Since this new way gives us such confidence, we can be very bold. We are not like Moses, who put a veil over his face so the people of Israel would not see the glory, even though it was destined to fade away. But the people's minds were hard, and to this day, whenever the old covenant is being read, the same veil covers their minds so they cannot understand the truth. And this veil can be removed only by believing in Christ. Yes, even today, when they read Moses' writing, their hearts are covered with that veil, and they do not understand. But whenever someone turns to the Lord, that veil is taken away. For the Lord is the Spirit, and wherever the Spirit of the Lord is, there is freedom. So all of us who have had the veil removed can see and reflect the glory of the Lord. And the Lord, who is the Spirit, makes us more and more like Him as we are changed into His glorious image. And that last sentence of 2 Corinthians 3, verse 18, is linked with the same verb that is used in Mark 9, linking the two passages. And the Moses typology, the Moses story, links these two passages. The giving of the law links these passages together. And Paul understands that as we encounter Jesus, as we allow the Spirit to move in our lives, then we are transformed into what it means to be truly human. We are transformed into what it means to be like Jesus, what it means to be his followers. And as Rob talked about caterpillars transforming into butterflies, and we are transformed somewhere along that continuum as we seek to be more and more like Jesus, as if that story were butterflying being that transformed humanity when we're truly with Jesus. And we're all kind of along that tree branch, along that path, seeking to be more and more like Him. And so ways to be like Him is to encounter the Spirit, to spend time with Him, to dwell with Him, and that through the Spirit allows us to be more and more transformed into His likeness and His image. As the people of Israel are supposed to reflect the image of God that was revealed to them in the law, so are we also commanded to reflect the image and the glory of the Lord. And this image of the glory of the Lord is revealed to us through Jesus' life, through His ministry, through His teaching, through His story, through His death, and through His resurrection. These are all things that point us to what it means to be truly human, what it truly means to be His followers, what it truly means to reflect His image. One of the lines that often come up as we transition to communion is from St. Augustine, "Behold what you are and become what you receive." And I really feel this is an appropriate line for today's teaching, for reflecting on what it means to be transformed. Because we are on that journey of becoming what we receive when we encounter the glory of the Lord revealed to us in the table. And it's not revealed to us on a mountaintop in a cloud. It's revealed to us through the bread and the cup, the symbols of what it means to truly be made in the image of Christ, what it means to follow after His ministry into His death and then into His resurrection. It's a journey of each week coming to encounter Him once again so that we continue progressing towards His image and likeness as we continue along that journey. So I invite you to come and to behold what we're in the process of becoming as we receive the bread and the cup. The symbols that Christ gave to us.